This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Chris Sullivan. I saw a quote from Congressman Adam Smith who wrote, quote, "It is hard to overstate just how dangerous high-level turnover at the Department of Defense is during a period of presidential transition," referring to the president's decision to, well, get rid of the defense secretary and some of his subordinates as this questioning of the election results goes on. So, Congressman, what do you think is going on here?
I think up front, it appears that the president is acting out of spite. As we know, he is, how can I put this exactly? He makes Nixon look, you know, warm and fuzzy and forgiving. He has an enemies list. If he doesn't like you and, you know, if you've said something that was insufficiently supportive, he's angry about it. And Secretary Esper, certainly, you know, when he contradicted the president on the use of the Insurrection Act this summer and in a number of other ways, the president didn't think he was sufficiently loyal and didn't think that a number of people at the Pentagon were sufficiently loyal. Remember, this is the deep state. So he's getting back at him. He's firing him. He's pulling him out. And he's trying to put his cronies in place. Trouble is, do his cronies know how to run the Pentagon? I don't think that they do, and there are important decisions that have to be made over there. So it's getting very dangerous for our nation's national security.
This is just out of spite, or is this, I mean, you know how rumors are, but it sounds like somebody who doesn't want to leave office making sure that his loyalists are running the military.
Yeah, no, that would be the second more frightening possibility. And that's why I say, if you ask me what's going on, I don't know. I don't know what's in the president's head. I don't know what he's planning. I'm quite confident that a good portion of it is that sort of petty vindictiveness, the idea that everybody has to be absolutely loyal to the president or he's going to, you know, get rid of them or get even with them in some way. I know that's part of it, but is it possible that he's trying to realign the elements of our bureaucracy so that they will support him in an election challenge? Absolutely. That's possible. I don't know for sure, but given what the president has said, it's not even remotely crazy to think that that's possible, and that's frightening.
So we have this move, and also we have this talk among Republicans of using what I believe they call the legislative solution to the election, where you would convene state legislatures and have them just select their own slate of electors who would simply vote as that state's government presumably wants them to vote. Now, I didn't even know that was a thing. What's your understanding of that?
Yeah, I'm right where you're at. It's like I'm vaguely aware. I didn't know that was a thing either. I thought that the way it worked is each campaign picks their electors from state by state, and then depending on who wins, those electors go forward. Now, obviously, it's a terrible system because, as we've learned, those electors are not bound by anything. I didn't know the legislature could step in. I'm not sure that's even constitutionally possible. But what's happening right now is the president, let me say Mitch McConnell and all the Republicans who are going along with him are participating in this. They are actively right now supporting a coup. You know, the election has been decided. Well, it hasn't been certified yet, but Joe Biden won the election, and they are trying to overturn the election. I mean, this happens, regrettably, in countries all around the world all the time. You have to battle over, you know, who won the election, and then they use the military or they use the courts or they use something to install their chosen candidate. You know, that is what the president and his supporters are trying to do right now. They are trying to tear up our Constitution and overthrow the duly elected government. And Mitch McConnell, all these other Republicans who are saying, oh, well, he's got his right to pursue his legal strategies. He's not pursuing legal strategies. He's lying. He's making stuff up about what happened in the election. And he's trying to overturn what actually happened in the election in a blatantly illegal and unconstitutional manner. This amounts to it's not violent yet, but to an illegal attempt to overthrow a duly elected government. And we ought to hold every single person who doesn't stand up against that accountable.
So what is the check and balance on this? So because what you're outlining here is, and this, I don't even know that I can bring myself to describe it because it sounds like something out of historical fiction. But you could potentially have state legislatures convening. They select a whole new slate of electors who ignore the popular vote and reelect Donald Trump as president. In the meantime, he's got a number of loyalists in the military. Presumably that goes down to the level of generals as well because he can remove them at will.
All right, But before we go too far down that road, let me say a couple things. First of all,
thank you for interrupting me. Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't think it's at all clear that the state legislatures have that power to simply choose electors and ignore the outcome of the election, number one. Number two, the states certify the election. We've seen what's going on in Georgia. The Secretary of State, you know, God bless him, actually doesn't want to participate in a coup and is just going to certify the election in Georgia. The states control the outcome. In Georgia, Arizona, Pennsylvania, Nevada, the states that were close, they certify the election for Joe Biden. And that's a legal fact. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then the only thing the president can do legally is find some reason to get the courts to say that the result was unfair. There was something wrong. So, there's no way. He's got nothing. OK, there's literally no argument whatsoever that there was anything wrong with these results. So if the states certify and the courts say, yeah, we're not getting involved in this, then Joe Biden is the president. Now, what people are nervous about at the Pentagon is, well, what if he calls out the military to, you know, arrest Joe Biden? And give? I can tell you, I am in close contact with senior leadership at the Pentagon. They have no intention whatsoever of doing that. The military will not support him in this. Look. The most likely scenario here is we have a narcissistic child as president, and he's lashing out because his toys were taken away from him. Regrettably, he's the president. So firing the Secretary of Defense, these are dangerous things. This is different than just throwing a temper tantrum in your playroom. It's dangerous. But does it lead to, you know, Trump holding on to the presidency over Biden? No. There's really not a path to that end. What it does do, however, is it really undermines our democracy. And all these Republicans, like I said, who are saying, well, you know, what does it hurt to let the president do this? You're basically telling people that you don't believe in democracy, that you don't believe in our elections. This was a close election. Donald Trump lost. We all need to accept that. We need to move on to the transition of Joe Biden and do our best to work together.
And I assume in any case, come January 20th, it doesn't matter who administers the oath. Somebody would administer Joe Biden the oath of office. And at that point, he becomes commander in chief.
Yep. And one of the bedrock principles, and this is something that I spoke with those senior Pentagon leaders, there's only one president at a time. And once January 20th comes, Donald Trump no longer has the power to give orders. Because that's the box. I mean, you know, everyone I know at the Pentagon wants to do the right thing. But Donald Trump's the commander in chief. If he gives an order, if it's not an illegal order, if it's not an unconstitutional order, you either follow it or you quit. Okay. And if you quit, then who knows who's going to come in behind you. But once we get to January 20th and Joe Biden is president, Donald Trump no longer has the ability to give anybody at the Pentagon orders.
Congressman Adam Smith, the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. Congressman, thank you very much.
Thanks, Dave. I appreciate the chance.
Choke points. Let's go. Another milestone for Sound Transit should be reached next weekend. The Linwood Extension is about to be extended over I-5. That should be quite an operation. Here's Chris.
Yep, the light rail extension from Northgate to Linwood travels on the east side of I-5 all the way to the Snohomish County line. But the Linwood station is on the west side of the freeway, so the light rail tracks will actually cross I-5 just north of the transit center in Mount Lake Terrace. Next weekend, the work on this connection over the freeway begins.
It's a lot of work, and it can't be done when the freeway is open for pretty obvious reasons.
Sound Transit's John Gallagher says contractors must close the freeway to get this work done. So next weekend, the southbound lanes of I-5 will be closed Friday, Saturday, and Sunday nights.
That's to construct false work. And false work is a temporary steel column system that's used to support the construction of the concrete deck on top of which the light rail trains are going to travel.
All southbound drivers are going to be forced to exit I-5 at 220th during these closures. The detour takes you south on 99 to Highway 104, where you can rejoin the freeway there. The closures begin at 11 o'clock each night. The freeway should be open by 6:30 the next morning. Southbound commuters that Monday morning next weekend will be driving under this false work structure for the first time. Sound Transit's Gallagher says northbound drivers will have a similar series of nighttime closures coming up.
In early 2021, we'll be doing the same thing for the northbound lanes, and we'll be giving people plenty of notice when we have that date nailed down.
It's been about a year and a half since Sound Transit started clearing the trees to make room for the Linwood extension. The construction's been moving at a pretty brisk pace ever since.
We're about 20% done with, you know, civil construction there. So things are moving along pretty rapidly. As anyone who drives along I-5 can see, the landscape is changing. The columns are going up, the girders are going in, you can really see what the shape of the alignment is going to be.
This extension to Linwood expected to open in 2024, the same year as light rail should open to Redmond. Going to be four stations along this route. Sound Transit says it will take you just about 30 minutes to get from Linwood to downtown Seattle once it's open.
Well, that sounds pretty good. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. All of us distanced this morning. On the issue of policing, there is now a new ballot initiative. It was launched yesterday, and the intention is to ban police chokeholds entirely. It's named after Manny Ellis, a black man who died in Tacoma police custody this year. But it goes well beyond just limiting police actions. Let's go to Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
Ellis's death as he was being restrained by Tacoma police was months before George Floyd's, but videos that came out later show it was eerily similar to Floyd's death, down to his plea of, "I can't breathe," as police restrained him, later citing his erratic behavior as the reason. The investigation was supposed to be handled independently under the state's new police accountability law, I-940, but it later came to light that that wasn't happening, prompting the family and their attorney to demand an independent investigation by the state, which remains ongoing.
The family is dedicated to getting justice for their loved one. They are dedicated to getting these officers prosecuted for the harm that they caused, for the killing of their loved one. They have a full range of emotions that they have experienced since that fateful day.
Ellis family attorney James Bible.
But at this moment, they're trying to channel their feelings, channel the hurt that they feel in such a way that they make sure or do the best they can to stop other family members and other people from experiencing what Manuel Ellis experienced on that night and what they have been experiencing ever since.
With that in mind,
we're here to announce the Manuel Ellis Washington Anti-Discrimination Act. This act would make it a human right, a civil right, to not be choked to death by police officers. This act will address excessive force and the disproportionalities in terms of excessive force. Hopefully, this act will save someone's life in the future.
I-1300 sponsor Lynn French.
I-1300 creates a new civil right which protects every resident from police chokehold. We would be the first state in the nation to declare a civil right which protects us from police chokeholds. So it's not just a criminal act, it's a civil action because we are declaring to end that.
But this initiative goes well beyond policing issues.
COVID-19 has really affected black and brown populations. And we really need this act to be able to ensure that essential workers who are primarily made up of the Latinx community, who are agriculture workers, they're in the cleaning industry, they're also in the healthcare industry, that we do not, as part of the Latinx community, black and brown lives do not get placed at the back of the line. We need an act that ensures equity in the distribution of the vaccines, and that is something that this act does. It helps take out discrimination in that distribution, and also ensuring that black and brown people do not get placed at the back of the line. This type of discrimination has been happening for years, and it is time to stop. My people are dying at one of the highest rates, and I will not stand idle and watch them die like this.
And after the failure of I-1000 last year, which would have undone the state's ban on affirmative action, the sponsor of that initiative and former state representative Jesse Weinberry says I-1300 finds a better way.
In addition to helping the BIPOC community, it also helps all veterans by enabling veterans who have received an honorable discharge to be eligible for affirmative action when it comes to education, employment, housing, and other essential needs that veterans have. This initiative, unlike many other affirmative action programs around the country, seeks to include all veterans and make sure they are beneficiaries of the forthcoming new affirmative action laws.
Just live now. So this, if this becomes a civil right, that makes these cases federal cases, is that correct?
I think they could be federal cases, yes. And then there would be, you can take legal action, which, in death cases, you can always sue federally for a wrongful death if there's a death in police custody. Right. But this creates this other avenue, specifically, though, about the chokehold. So it wouldn't have to lead to a death, I don't believe.
Okay, so I guess I'm still unclear as to what changes here. Is this a way of getting around the idea that that most of these things are investigated internally by police departments?
That's a whole nother discussion. This would specifically ban chokeholds and neck restraints of all kinds by police, and then which are not currently banned in our state.
Oh, I see. So under any circumstances, I just was curious as to why. What making it a civil right does, how that enhances the protection.
It opens up the door for more legal action. So it's not just a criminal act. You can then, and it doesn't have to raise to the level of a wrongful death. You can go ahead and take a civil action against the officers.
So anytime somebody even attempts a chokehold or a knee on the neck, that becomes a civil rights violation every bit as serious as banning somebody from a restaurant due to race.
Yes, because they would be completely banned. Yeah. And it's seen as discriminatory. You're not supposed to use them.
Now, on the vaccine angle, tell me more about that.
This would require that everyone in the state get the vaccine. And then it also has some language in there about not discriminating when it comes to treatment and testing, making sure everybody has an equitable availability of those type things. But it specifically requires the free vaccine be given and be given in an equitable way. Exactly what that will end up looking like, I'm not quite clear on, but that's the language in this initiative, which is quite lengthy.
Now, what we've been told all along is that the first vaccine doses would be given to frontline workers, in other words, healthcare workers. But would this leapfrog that and say the first vaccine also has to go to farm workers too? Or
no, it's saying that when we have it needs to be available at no cost regardless of any kind of sexual orientation, race and all of that, right. And that it acknowledges though that the health workers, the frontline workers, have to get that first. It just wants to make sure they're not at that everyone else, people of color, BIPOC communities, are not at the end of the line, and essential workers, your agriculture workers, people like that, are not at the back of the line, and also that it's given free at no cost, again, to everyone in the state. That's not specific to people of color.
Okay, I get that. I mean, in terms of, nobody's ever going to say, here's the vaccine, but white people get it first. I assume the problem is that they're worried that the distribution centers or the clinics might not be as many in minority areas as white areas. Is that right?
Possibly, but they specifically point to, first of all, this is an emergency. It's shaped as an emergency measure because they point to several things. One, the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation declaring racism a public health emergency. And then also they point to the disproportionate effect that COVID-19 in Washington state has had on the BIPOC community, specifically Latinx community, which has the highest numbers proportionally of COVID-19 deaths and cases, I do believe. And so they point to all of that and make this an emergency issue. And I'm sorry, I forgot your original question.
Well, I get that. The racism is bad, but what I've learned over the years is that you can't cure racism just by passing a law that says racism is bad. So I'm just trying to figure out what this looks like on the ground. Would this then require making sure that there's equity in terms of the actual centers or outlets where the vaccine is being distributed?
And I don't know what it would look like as far as how it would be, organized and how it would play out on the ground. I do know that it would make sure that they don't have people at the back of the line who are people of color who are seeing the highest rates of this disease. That's the goal. I think that you would have to draw up those plans once this were to pass, is my understanding, because I don't see anything specific in the initiative that describes what you're asking about.
Okay. Guy Reyes, Hannah Scott. Hannah, thank you.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness now. It's sponsored by Mike Novak and ListWithNovak.com. I told you about this man in this story at the start of the pandemic, but he was apparently so popular that I couldn't get an interview with him. But our ace afternoon editor and anchor, Diane Duthweiler, got an interview recently, so I'm really excited to share this update. This King County man has become a father figure around the world with his dad, How Do I videos.
When it first went viral, I was like, this could go viral and just as easily go away. And so I've tried to maintain trust with my subscribers by understanding why I started this in the first place. And I want to remain true to that and still just try to help people.
The Dad How Do I videos were something Rob Kenny and his daughter started when the pandemic started. Now they have nearly 3 million YouTube subscribers. And it began with this video.
So today I'm going to show you how to tie a tie. A couple of quick hints for you. When you're picking out a tie, you want to pick out a tie that has some sort of color that picks up something in your shirt. It's just an added classy little touch.
And Rob tells us that is still his favorite Dad How Do I video. Since then, he's also added a dad joke to each lesson.
Hey, kids. So mom calls me and says, honey, the van won't start. Do you think you can jump it? And I thought, well, I think if I had a running start, I could probably get over the car, but I don't think I can get over the van.
And like all dads.
I don't know that I'd call him stupid. Maybe corny. Corny's a better word. That was something I was unsure of whether I was going to do, and it started out with the stud finder. I thought, obviously, there's a dad joke there.
What isn't a joke? Rob's inspiration for his effort. He was raised without a father and says he wants to help others without the kind of guidance he wished he had had. Since he's become an internet sensation, Kenny has companies getting in touch with him asking to be a pitch man for their products, but he's only accepted a few offers.
I'm not going to be an infomercial, and I want to maintain trust with my subscribers. I call them my kids. I address them that way when I start a video. Now I say, hey, kids.
And now, in addition to Kenny's how-to videos, he reads children's books.
Oh, yeah, it's true. The other seeds, they look at me and they say, that seed is so bad. When they think I'm not listening, they mumble, there goes a bad seed.
And some videos are just positive thoughts or fatherly reassurance that everything will be all right.
Oh, yeah, it's true. The other seeds, they look at me and they say, that seed is so bad. When they think I'm not listening, they mumble, there goes a bad seed.
Yeah, there's that same bad seed book, which is really popular with kids. But as far as the reassurance, he just gives the kind of guidance and kindness that we've gotten used to during this segment. So I want to thank him for that effort. It's so needed these days.
It is. I got a stud finder, but I have told her that arm's length or it would just be constantly going off. And now from the G and Ursula Show, which begins at 9 o'clock right here on Cairo Radio, here he is, G. Scott. You've seen that Governor Inslee is apparently on the short list for a cabinet position in the Biden administration. And, of course, this has been predicted for a long time. Do you think he should take it if offered? And are you one of those who thinks that Washington State would be better off without him?
Take it, Governor Jay. Take it. Go ahead and take it. Yeah, we'll be fine without Governor Jay Inslee. Look, Governor Jay Inslee has done a great job, right? And when I mean a great job, when you start talking about the response towards COVID, we can agree to disagree. Everybody can have their things when it comes to Governor Jay Inslee. But for me, I think he has done a good job with that. But I do think that if he was not in office and he went to go out there with Biden and those guys, I'm pretty comfortable with who it would be. And in this case, it would be Denny Heck. Yeah. And so somebody who's been in the game for a long time, who's worked with others. He's worked with other chiefs of staff back in the day from 89 to 93. He's been in there ever since. So I think they're fine. Governor Jay Inslee is like the guy that your daughter's dating. Nice guy. You just don't have anything in common with him, right? Like, he didn't do anything wrong. Like, he just went in there and he wants to, like, he doesn't like sports. He's like, no, I don't really watch sports. I'm really into this.
He's a pretty good basketball player.
Wasn't he football too in high school? My mom went to high school with him.
No, I'm not talking about that with Governor Jay Inslee. I'm talking if somebody, like, you know, dating the nice guy, he just got into the same things that you're into. There's really no connection. And that's how I am with Governor Jay Inslee. He's a nice guy. He's done a good job. But for me, there's really no connection with Governor Jay Inslee. So do I think Washington State would be fine? Washington State would be fine if Governor Jay Inslee rolled out. I think Denny Heck would be fine.
If he rolled out, where do you think he's best suited in the Biden cabinet? EPA, Department of Energy.
Handling wills for the country, like for grandparents to get their kids in wills and stuff.
What?
Isn't that what he talked about? Remember during the beginning of the pandemic, and he was like, "Hey, you know, kick your children out of your will. Tell them you're not going to be in the will anymore." So yeah, maybe he can be good at that.
Okay.
I missed that one.
You guys missed that one. Come on, guys.
No, I remember you railing on that because you're like, well, if all of us could be so lucky to have parents who would pass on, you know, a fortune to us. Do you think a lockdown's coming?
Yes.
Another one like in March?
Yes, I do. But hold on. This is really important. If they're going to send a lockdown, then you better send some bread. Excuse me. You better send some money. You cannot expect Americans to lock down, close businesses up, not work, and not send money. So when they do it this time, you better send folks some money. So if you're going to do a lockdown for 30 days, you're going to do a lockdown for, you know, for either 4 weeks to 6 weeks, you cannot lock down without sending people money. Period. Like, that has to be done.
Yeah. Well, the problem is, I mean, the lockdown, though, comes from the state level, and the money comes from the federal level.
Well, considering we're in limbo for the next 68, 69 days, that's a little scary as well. But yes, Colleen, Dave, I do think that is coming. I mean, cases are spreading like crazy everywhere. Like right now, my mom is just absolutely afraid to leave the house. She can't even, as a matter of fact, her doctor's office, the new deal now, if she goes to the doctor, you have to get a COVID test before you even come in there. Wow. So it is starting to spread. Now, for anybody that wants to say, it's not a hoax and here's the percentages, stop it. It is real right now. It's even more so the increase that's happening.
G. Scott joins Ursula at 9 o'clock. Thanks, G.
See you guys. You can ring my bell.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. People are going out to eat again, but they're eating earlier. And Rachel Bell will explain to us why.
So according to an article from the Wall Street Journal called The Early Bird Special is now everyone's favorite restaurant reservation. People are going out to eat again, but mostly eating outside because it's safer in the pandemic, which means they're eating earlier because it's getting darker earlier. The sun is setting. It's getting cold in most places, and people don't want to be cold when they're outside. The other reason is they've been at work all day in their own house, and they just want to get out of the house so badly that they're willing to eat at 4:30. If that's what it takes to get out of the house and have dinner. So according to someone they interviewed named Christian Mork, a Danish novelist, he said 5 p.m. is the new 9 p.m. You hold out all day and then you stuff yourself at 5. This
that,
is perfect
that doesn't
for
sound,
my...
doesn't sound like a relaxing experience to me.
Well, he actually did also say that you don't enjoy the food as much, but I don't really know why. So outdoor dining, according to this article, made up 44% of the sales at full service establishments in August, which is the most recent number from the National Restaurant Association. And so, yeah, I've been feeling this as well. Like, some restaurants and bars with outdoor seating have the heat lamps and some mm-hmm. don't. And even the ones with heat lamps, you can't really feel them at all the locations. So I don't know if it's just because, you know, we had daylight savings and the seasons are changing, but I feel so tired so early recently. I was wondering if you've been experiencing that. I understand wanting to eat earlier because honestly, you know, with the pandemic and the lack of socializing that's happening in the colder weather, I've been getting in bed sometimes at 7:30, like not to go to sleep, but I'll just get in to be cozy and start reading.
I'm not that bad, but I've been going to bed a lot. I've been going to bed at the time I should have been all along, given that I wake up at, you know, 3:55 in the morning.
Yeah.
But yeah, there are some days where I look around and said, there's really nothing to do. I might as well go to bed.
Someone in this article said something interesting that I like. She said, it's turning us all into farmers because we are on the schedule with the sun. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's so true. The sun is down. We retreat home. The sun is up. We wake. But the problem a lot of people are saying is, and I can relate to this as well, is if you eat dinner at 4:30 at 9 o'clock, you are peckish again and you tend to not make the healthiest choices. So all the snacks come out, you know, later in the evening.
Yeah. One sure way to control your appetite is to go around smelling like an old book. I wish there was a way I could do that conveniently without having to actually have an old book.
Oh, but there is.
Is there?
Yeah. So I think most people in the Pacific Northwest are probably familiar with Powell's Books in Portland. It's one of the most famous and best bookstores in the country. And they have just released a perfume. I was surprised to hear a unisex fragrance called Powell's by Powell's. And they claim that it is the scent of a bookstore with hints of violet wood. And I'm not quite sure how to pronounce this. Biblichor.
I have not heard of it.
B-I-B-L-I-C-H-O-R. Let's see here. They said it is meant to replicate the smell of old paper that, quote, creates an atmosphere ripe with mood and possibility, invoking a labyrinth of books, secret libraries, ancient scrolls, and cognac swilled by philosopher kings. Now, if you think, who wants to smell like an old book or a bookstore? This went on sale on Sunday for pre-order, and they've received more than 1,200 orders by the time this article was printed.
Wow. Well, the shortcut to that is just to get your grandmother's edition of War and Peace and rub it on yourself.
Just
right?
Rub it all over you. Yeah. Well, they said that this was invented to help people who are missing old bookstores with their creaky floors and their musty smells during the pandemic. Yeah. But
well, smell is very powerful. It can evoke all sorts of... I just finished reading, by the way, part of my isolation reading list. There's two books, one called Perfume and the other called The Emperor of Scent, which is all about perfumes. And I don't know if you've read any of these books or read anything about the science of creating perfumes, but the descriptors that they use, like you were using in the article, you know, the woody smell redolent of chocolate and musty old books, they've got all these descriptors that the descriptions themselves sometimes will make you smell the thing they're describing.
Yeah. It's interesting. The reason that smell, you know, is so close to memory is because those two parts are next to each other in your brain. I mean, everybody has that experience where you smell something and it takes you back to something earlier in your life. And I also coincidentally got this email a couple weeks ago that I didn't delete, but I didn't know what to do with it. And I guess I kept it because now it's coming in handy. It says, "Hi, Rachel. I wanted to reach out to you as a reminder that Demeter Fragrance has been producing a Play-Doh scent for nearly 15 years. And they go on to say how much people love this whimsical scent reminiscent of their childhood.
Rachel Bell. Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks, Dave Ross.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.